Since that moment, I've always told people I knew it would read well in a book. There's no better than adversity. Every defeat, every heartbreak, every loss contains its own seed, its own lesson on how to improve your performance the next time. Malcolm X. And just in case you think I'm looking back at the past through rose-colored glasses, consider this interview I did with my friend, the culture vulture DJ Vlad, literally the day after I got fired from Philly. Vlad, yesterday on Twitter, we got some shocking news that you actually yourself broke. Me. Yeah, I put out on Twitter that I got fired from the beat in Philly. It wasn't nothing for me to break the news. My life is an open book. It's nothing for me to share something like that. On to the next one. I know what type of personality I have. I have politically incorrect views and potentially dangerous rhetoric. So when you're someone like me, there's always a chance you can get fired. Vlad, what's the next move? Me. Charlemagne's gonna do what Charlemagne does. You know, radio will be here in one hot second. There will be another station calling in one hot second. They didn't cut my tongue out. I didn't lose my voice. I'm still good. You're still gonna hear from Charlemagne. You gotta roll the dice. With great risk comes great reward. Wendy told me some real shit once. When Puffy allegedly got her fired from Hot 97 back in the day, she told me that it was the best thing that ever happened to her brand. So history has a strange way of repeating itself, doesn't it? The confidence I projected while talking to Vlad wasn't fake, but firing number four was still the toughest for me to handle. Not because I was concerned about how it would impact my career, but again, because of how it might affect my family. As I said, Mook Mook and I had signed a lease on a townhouse in Cherry Hill near Philadelphia. In anticipation of the move, she'd given her job 2 weeks' notice and sent our daughter down to Monk's Corner to stay with our parents while we packed up our stuff. The day I was fired, I literally had all our possessions in my Cadillac Escalade to take to Cherry Hill. Thankfully, the owners of the townhouse gave us our deposit back and let us out of our lease, but that also meant we had nowhere to live. Instead of moving into our new townhouse, we headed to Mook Mook's grandmother's apartment in the housing projects in Coney Island, Brooklyn. We crashed there for 2 weeks while I tried to figure out what I was going to do next. Half the time, I was determined to ride it out in New York until the next opportunity presented itself. The other half, I was telling myself, I can't raise a child in New York. I'm not a city kid, and I don't want my daughter to be one either. Every day, I'd see the pros and cons of each path. My mind was all over the place. Then one morning, I woke up next to my girl and had a moment of clarity. I knew that I couldn't make any smart decisions where I was at. I needed to make those decisions back where I was from. It was almost the inverse of those old Rakim lyrics. I needed to reconnect with my core before I could make the right decision about my future. And my core was Monk's Corner. Still, the idea of moving my family back into my mother's house at 30 years old was a bit worrisome. Then I had a very powerful conversation with my close friend, Kendra Gilliam, a.k.a. Kendra G, who was another jock on the beat in Philly. It was truly one of the best pep talks I ever received. Charlemagne, just enjoy your time in South Carolina, Kendra told me reassuringly. Hit the reset button, because you've been going hard for years, and you need this time with your family. And when the next opportunity comes, it's going to be a big one. And then family time is going to be hard to come by. Encouraged by her words, I jumped into my Escalade with over 200,000 miles on it. My girl got in her 2003 Honda Civic, and together we made the 13-hour ride back to South Carolina. I hadn't lived in the state in almost 4 years, but it wouldn't be long before I'd be reminded that in the eyes of some, I'd fallen off. I remember not long after coming home, I got into an argument with my little sister, Ashley. Look at you. You used to be with Wendy and had a radio show in Philly, she gloated. Now you back living at home with Mama. It was intended to be a low blow. But what she failed to mention is that while I was moving back in with our mother, my sister at that time had never even left. This is temporary for me, I reminded her, but it's permanent for you. I know that's a harsh thing to say to your sister, but I like to think those words had a positive impact on her as well, because after that, she did move out of my mama's house and is currently living in Atlanta with our sister. She's trying to better herself. There were more than a few folk in Monk's Corner who probably took perverse pleasure in my less than triumphant return. Still, I wasn't going to walk around hanging my head. Instead, I savored and enjoyed every moment with my family like Kendra told me to do. Unlike in New York, I had no problem walking into the Berkeley County Unemployment Office and picking up my checks. I hadn't collected anything the other times I'd been fired, so I ended up getting around $1,300 every 2 weeks. Not much to live off in New York, but in Monk's Corner, that's ballin'. Without having to worry about rent or childcare, we were actually able to save up a little bit of money. I used that to take occasional trips back to New York to stay relevant. I would make appearances on Angela Yee's SiriusXM show Lip Service. I tape episodes of Hood State of the Union, a web series I created with my good friend, the comedian Little Duval. Angela Yee played a major role in my life, even before The Breakfast Club. If Angela knew I had an issue with a certain artist and they were going to be on Lip Service, she'd give me the heads up and let me call in. One time, she let me go at the rapper Mims, and I destroyed him. It was great radio. Another time Angela called me, a gay dude named Glitter Dick put out a video saying he was my boyfriend. We had fun going at each other, and it turned into another great moment. Those moments kept me on the public's radar. Angela, Little Duval, and I also did a pilot for a hip-hop version of First Take. Terrence J was going to executive produce it, but BET never aired it. Terrence did tell me something I've always remembered, though. Y'all three should do a radio show. It rang true to me. So I, in turn, told Angela, one day you and I will do mornings on Power 105.1 in New York. I swear I said that verbatim. Angela was skeptical, though. How, she asked. You're not even on the radio, and I've only done satellite. Plus, they'll never fire Ed Lover, she said, referring to the radio legend who was Power's morning show host at the time. I don't know how it'll happen, I replied. I just know it's going to happen. Today, I believe I spoke our current situation into fruition during that conversation with Angela. I might not have been on the radio, but stations were still interested in me. Every few weeks, I got offered a new gig, but the market or the situation never felt quite right. I could tell the program directors were shocked when I tell them no thanks. After all, I was living back in South Carolina and collecting unemployment. Who was I to be choosy? But I was supremely confident that God was about to give me something greater than what those stations could offer. The hand that feeds. Before we get to the next stop God had planned for me, I want to take a look at one final situation that on the surface seemed to be a loss, but on deeper inspection actually helped set up one of my biggest wins. When I became Wendy Williams' sidekick, I had two main goals. One, be the best I could be on her show, which I knew would set up the rest of my career. And two, put South Carolina's hip-hop scene on the map. As much as I love seeing the way the state had helped set up the careers of artists like T.I. and Jeezy, I also wanted to see local artists achieve the same level of success. To that end, in 2008, I hooked up with Lightyear EMI to put out a compilation called South Crack, featuring artists from Charleston, Columbia, and of course, Monk's Corner. The album didn't sell many copies, and since the deal called for me to pay for all the marketing, production, and publicity costs, I didn't make a dime off the project. But it did help create a buzz for several artists. In 2009, I met Swiss Beatz at the video shoot for Mano's High Hater. I was blown away when Swiss told me he loved what I was doing on Wendy's show. He had made the beats for so many songs that have been the soundtrack of my life. I couldn't really believe he appreciated what I was doing on the radio. At the end of the conversation, Swiss told me, "Yo, if I can help with anything you got going on, let me know." I didn't have to think hard about taking Swiss up on his offer. If someone offers me an opportunity, they're not going to have to tell me twice. "Well, I got this album I just put out, and I'm really trying to get one of these guys signed to a major," I quickly told Swiss, while handing him one of the copies I always kept on me for situations like that one. God, Jewel, when someone offers to help you, tell them exactly what you want. Don't beat around the bush. If you're not crystal clear about what your ask is, chances are you won't get anything. When I followed up with Swiss a week or so later to see what he thought, he told me he hadn't had a chance to listen yet, but added, "Just tell me the one artist you've got on there that's the most popping, and I'll take you to whatever label you want to." It was an incredible offer. Having Swiss Beatz walk you into the label of your choice is like getting a hip-hop version of Willy Wonka's Golden Ticket. I wanted to make the right choice, so I hit up DJ Frosty to ask his opinion, and without hesitation, he said, "Little Rue." A lot of people thought Rue had an energy like Mystical, so it was a smart choice. "Yo, I like this kid's tone," Swiss replied. After I sent him Rue's Nasty song, "Get him up here." Rue flew up and spent a few days in the studio with Swiss, where they collaborated on four tracks. Swiss was one of the hottest producers in the game, but he still blocked off time in his schedule for Rue. After they recorded those four songs, it was time for us to decide on a label. I wanted to go with Asylum, since they were having tremendous success with Southern artists like Mike Jones, Paul Wall, Boosie, Webby, Gucci Mane, Waka Flocka, OJ the Juice Man, and Shorty Low. Swiss agreed with me, so he set up a meeting with Joey I.E., the industry legend who was running the label at the time, and his right-hand man, Jay Grant. The meeting included myself, Little Rue, Swiss, Jonathan Stevens, who was Rue's manager at the time, and Kevin Hunter, who was acting as my business partner. After we played them the track Swiss had produced, Asylum was all in. Jay Grand's idea was to release Rue's album under Shoddy Records, an imprint he'd just set up, and everyone agreed that was a great look. The final deal was that 50% of the money would be split between my company, Stupid Dope Moves Incorporated, and Little Rue's company, Presidential, with the other 50% going to Shoddy Asylum. Swiss didn't even ask for a cut. Even though he'd made the music and set up the meeting, he was just happy to give a new artist a shot. On the way out of the meeting, Swiss pulled me aside and asked me a question I've always remembered. "Is Rue your man?" he asked. "Yeah, that's my guy," I replied. "Good," said Swiss, "but make sure all your business is straight anyway. I've done this 100 times, and trust me, once money gets involved, people tend to flip, whether they're your man or not." Before the paperwork was even done, we managed to get several important DJs to play Nasty Song. Probably the most important was DJ Envy, who was one of the hottest DJs in the country on New York City's Hot 97. Envy agreed to meet Kevin and me for lunch while we played him Nasty Song. Envy recognized Rue's talent right away and promised to play the song without asking for anything in return. "I know we live in the payola age, but I promise you, neither Envy nor any of the other respectable DJs we approached asked for a cent. It was a hot tune, and they were happy to help out a new artist in an underrepresented region on the map." Due to the hype we created around Nasty Song, other labels began looking to sign Rue too. One day, Jonathan Rue called me out of the blue and said, "Charlamagne, we know we have a deal with Asylum, but we want to sign with Def Jam instead." "No, we already agreed to a deal with Asylum," I replied. "You don't want to mess with that. Trust me, it's the best look for you." Rue and Jonathan thought they could do better. Bless their hearts. Those guys are country. I was country too, but they were on another level. Like match your car with your sneakers or get all your real teeth removed and replace them with gold country. And they'd been overly impressed by Def Jam's star power. "Go on Def Jam's website," Rue told me. "They got people like Jay-Z, Rihanna, Kanye, Jeezy, and Rick Ross. That's where I finna be." "That's cool," I told Rue. "But now go on their site and look at the other 60 artists that they've signed that you've never heard of. That's what's going to happen to you if you sign with Def Jam." Rue still wasn't convinced. So I got him and Jonathan back on the phone with Jay Grand, who patiently went over the pros and cons of signing with Asylum. It seemed like he got through to them, and I figured the matter was resolved. The next week, I was listening to Hot 97, and Envy played Nasty Song. "My dog," I texted Rue. "Envy's got Nasty Song on Hot 97 right now." "Fuck you. You got me fucked up," Rue texted me right back. "It's on sight when I see you. You got people thinking we in business together, ruining my life. Now I can't even do the deal with Def Jam because of you." When I saw that text, I was devastated. I literally had to sit down and collect myself. Damn, all I did was help, I thought. I gave this kid the shot of a lifetime, and that was fuck you? A few weeks later, Rue signed with Def Jam. And as Swiss had warned me, the paperwork became a nightmare. Though he never mentioned it to us, it turned out Rue had already signed a deal with a production company in Atlanta. I became convinced Rue was a contract whore, someone who would sign his name to anything without wanting to honor it down the road. Despite the complications, my attorney at the time, Jill Ramsey, negotiated a deal with Def Jam for $150,000. Little Rue got $80,000, then the company in Atlanta got $40,000. That left $30,000 for myself, DJ Frosty, and Kevin Hunter to split. So when it was all said and done, I only made $10,000 on the deal. Don't get me wrong, that was still the biggest check I'd ever received. Yet for some reason to this day, I hear Rue still tell people I stole $70,000 from him, which is complete bullshit. More so than the accusations and the money, what hurt me the most was the missed opportunity. The Def Jam album bombed. Only 1,400 people bought it its first week in stores, making it likely you've never heard of Rue until this book. I'm still convinced it would have been different if he'd kept his word and signed to Asylum. That misstep truly broke my heart. I used to get anxiety attacks just thinking about it, to the point where I had to go see a doctor. Putting South Carolina on the map meant that much to me, and I knew, correctly as it turned out, that it might be a long time before another opportunity that perfect came around again for another local artist. Oh, by the way, it still hasn't. Still, as with all my so-called losses, I took several lessons from the situation. The greatest was that you can never, even if the situation blows up in your face, hurt yourself by helping others. Swiss showed me that no matter how big you are, you can always help the next person. If they don't capitalize on your assistance, that's on them. But never let it affect your willingness to give of yourself. As Swiss told me, he saw the situation between Rue and myself play out hundreds of times before. He probably pulled my coat because he saw what was coming down the road. But it still didn't stop him from setting up that meeting or making those beats for Rue. That's just the type of individual Swiss is. The same with Envy. You know how many people ask him to play that record every day? Today, we're partners on the biggest hip-hop radio show in the country, The Breakfast Club. But Envy didn't know me from Adam back then. He didn't have to help me, but Envy is a giver. So when you go on Instagram and see his big mansion, fleet of fancy cars, and most important, his beautiful family, know that's how he got to where he is today. Just like Swiss, they got all that through giving. Good givers are great getters. Russell Simmons. In life, there's no losses, even the ones that give you anxiety attacks. Only lessons. That's because you live and you learn. Principle 5. Put the weed in the bag. Success is a process. There are no cheat codes, no life hacks, no shortcuts, and no half steps. Opportunity always comes before money, but sadly, a lot of us don't recognize it unless there's a paycheck attached. Don't make that mistake. When you're just starting out, put yourself in the position to be a part of the process, and then get that money. Despite all the drama surrounding Rue signing with Def Jam, my relationship with Jay Grant and Joey I.E. remained strong. I stayed in touch with them throughout the rest of my run with Wendy, my time in Philly, and even after I went back to Mom's Corner. I wasn't on the radio then and couldn't do anything for them, but they would always reply to my emails and welcome me into the asylum offices when I was in town. I've never forgotten that. If you want to see a person's true character, watch how they treat people who seemingly can't help them. I've seen so many folks lose my number or stop returning my emails after I got fired. In the words of 50 Cent, these industry niggas ain't friends. They know how to pretend. Because Joey wasn't one of those fake industry guys, during one of my visits to New York, he linked me up with G-Spin, the legendary DJ who was then the music director at Power 105.1, as well as the DJ on Boston's Jammin' 94.5. A few weeks later, Kevin Hunter and I were able to get a meeting with him at Power to see if there would be any interest in me coming there. I thought the sit-down went well, but Power never followed up with anything firm. So I headed back to Mount's Corner and waited for the right opportunity to present itself. I knew I had the talent to succeed in New York, but the longer the phone didn't ring with any offer from a New York station, the more I started questioning my value. Had I overestimated my worth? Should I take a job in the Carolinas so I could at least start providing for my family again? Get back to being on the air? One night I decided to take a walk down the dirt road by my mom's house. As I breathed in the clean country air, I said a prayer like I always do, simply asking God for direction. After a few minutes, any worries or insecurities I had been experiencing faded from my thoughts. I felt completely at peace. And then out of nowhere, a voice commanded, "Go to New York on Monday. Go." I didn't have a reason to go, but there was no disobeying this command. If Saul had had his epiphany on the road to Damascus, then I'd had mine on the dirt road in Monk's Corner. If New York was where I wanted to be, then I had to stop waiting on an invitation and take myself to the action. God, Jewel, always follow your instincts, because your instincts are God's voice telling you what to do. And you better listen closely, because God doesn't repeat himself and God isn't loud. Whenever you hear that faint whisper in your head telling you what direction to move in, that's where you want to go. That Monday, I flew to New York and decided to pay a visit to Mike Kaiser of Atlantic Records. Mike is one of my all-time favorite people in the game. One of those guys who will always treat you right no matter what position you are in at a given moment. You might not have heard of Mike. You've probably seen him, though. When Jay-Z used to have courtside seats for the Nets, Mike was the tall, dark-skinned guy who looks like John Sally always sitting next to Jay. But he's one of the most plugged-in people in the entire industry. He knows about almost every deal before it happens, and has helped shape more of them than the world will probably ever know. When I got to Mike's office, he quickly filled me in on some of the rumblings that were going on. "You know what Power is planning, right?" Mike asked me. "Nope, not really," I answered truthfully. "Yes, I knew I was in the mix, but like I said, we've been treading water for months. They're talking about putting together a new morning show, and they've been kicking your name around," Mike said. "Word, that would be dope," I replied, knowing that if Mike was talking about it, it was probably more than just a rumor. Sure enough, not more than a day after talking to Mike, Power's program director, Cadillac Jack, hit me up and asked if I wanted to grab lunch. We went out and ended up talking for several hours. It was an amazing conversation, as much about life as about radio. As we headed back to the station, we randomly bumped into a woman named Tia, who used to be an intern on Wendy's show. Oh my God, Charlemagne, it's so great to see you, she exclaimed upon seeing me. When are you going to get back on the air? You were too good on Wendy's show. Radio needs you. It couldn't have been scripted any better. When Tia left, Catty turned to me and said, that just don't happen. I walk the streets all the time with jocks who are on the air, and nobody runs up to them with that sort of excitement. I don't know if there had been any hesitation on Catty's part before that lunch, but I left feeling like there was no doubt I was going to be working at Power in some capacity. Sure enough, a few weeks later, my contract came through, and I found myself part of the station's all-new morning show, The Breakfast Club. It had been 13 years since I'd started as an unpaid intern at Jams back in Charleston, and now I was finally where I'd always wanted to be, co-hosting my own show in New York City. Spending a year in Mom's Corner waiting for the right opportunity had been hard, but in the end, it had proven to be the right choice. If I had been able to drop my own dream job, I couldn't have picked a better situation than The Breakfast Club. My co-hosts on the show were going to be my friends, DJ Envy and Angela Yee, who both had the perfect combination of experience and humility to succeed as co-hosts. Envy had been Miss Jones' co-host on New York's Hot 97, and Angela had been Cypher Sound's co-host on Shade 45. Add on that I was Wendy's co-host, and you end up with a team that knew how to play their positions. I knew that meant we wouldn't get sidetracked by the needless bickering that brings down a lot of shows. Plus, with iHeartMedia, we'd be working for the most powerful radio network in the country and have access to all their incredible talent and resources. It also meant I'd get to learn at the feet of two of the most influential people in radio, Doc Winters, iHeart's longtime head of urban radio, and iHeart CEO Bob Pittman. Most important, the show would give me a whole new level of exposure. Despite my stint with Wendy, many folks across the country didn't have a real sense of who I was until I joined The Breakfast Club. It might have seemed like I was an overnight success, but you and I, faithful listener, know better. There were so many baby steps I had to take, so many setbacks I had to endure, and obstacles I had to overcome until I finally made the leap into The Breakfast Club. Too often, we're given bad advice on what it takes to get from where we are to where we want to be. We're taught that the only accurate sign that we're moving towards success is making money. We get caught up sweating the results instead of embracing the process, even though embracing the process is the only way you're ever going to get what you want out of life. There are a lot of gems in the iconic hip-hop flick Belly, but perhaps my favorite one is when DMX's character Tommy Bun says, learn how to put the weed in the bag first, then get money. Let me put that quote in context. DMX was speaking to a couple of young hustlers, Wise and Lakid, who hadn't even sold their first nickel bag of weed yet, but were already talking about getting big-time coke money. Tommy Buns was telling them to slow down and focus on the work in front of them, no matter how small the job might seem, instead of immediately looking forward to the big scores. If they couldn't even put the weed in the bag first, how were they going to go out and become major players? Belly might have been detailing the drug game, but put the weed in the bag first applies to every industry and profession. Whether you want to be a DJ, a lawyer, an engineer, a doctor, a musician, or an investment banker. There are no cheat codes, no life hacks, or shortcuts to success. You have to embrace the process before you can reap the rewards. You're always going to have to put the weed in the bag first. Working for free. One of the first steps in embracing the process, especially when you're just starting out in your career, is accepting that you might have to work for damn near nothing, maybe even for free. I realize that might sound like strange advice to find in a book from a hip-hop personality. After all, get money is pretty much the culture's mantra. From songs to videos to interviews, almost every rapper or hip-hop personality you hear from is going to tell you, if it don't make dollars, it don't make sense. Not me. In fact, I'm here to tell you just the opposite. Often the smartest moves you make will be the ones that don't make you a pretty penny. At least at first. I believe the first rule of the game should always be get your foot in the door by any means possible. If you demand a check, that door might only open a crack, if that. If you're willing to work for free, however, that door is going to open up, often wide enough for you to stride right in. Working for free is usually seen as something only rich kids can afford to do. You know those kids from fancy colleges who can take an unpaid internship at Vice or BuzzFeed because their parents are already paying the rent and giving them spending money? That might often be the case, but it doesn't mean that you need rich parents to work for free. Trust me, my pops didn't have any trust fund set up for me when I got my foot in the door with that unpaid internship at Jams. Throughout the whole process of trying to establish myself as a radio personality, I was always hurting for money. Some times were better than others, but I never felt comfortable. Even then, I never let wanting to get paid get in the way of a good opportunity. I was able to capitalize on the opportunity at Z93 Jams by hustling my ass off at all sorts of menial jobs. I would take any job during the day as it meant being able to hang out at the station at night. Later, when Jams was only paying me 19 grand a year, or when Hot in Columbia only put me on one day a week, I'd happily throw parties to make ends meet. The most important time I didn't let money, or the lack thereof, get in the way of a golden opportunity is when I agreed to work for Wendy for free. Yes, I am making money hand over fist today, but that's only because I didn't have my hand out when Kev made me that offer over dinner. When Kev casually threw in, "But we can't pay you," that would have been the end of the conversation for a lot of folks. They would have said, "You guys are making millions, but I'm supposed to work for free? Get the fuck out of here." And according to conventional wisdom, I should have said the same thing. It's not like I was a novice at that point. I'd been on the air for several years and was hosting my own successful show in Columbia. How are you going to tell someone who already has a track record of getting paid, even if it's only $10 an hour, that they should start working for free? Yet, I ended up spending a year and a half working for Wendy for free. I didn't earn a dime from the show during that period, but I don't feel like I wasted a single second. In my mind, I wasn't doing anything all those months but putting the weed in the bag, without complaint. Every day I was bagging up my personality, my humor, and my POV, and delivering it to the listeners. Over time, the listeners, not to mention program directors, would smoke those proverbial bags and say, "Man, Charlamagne's got some good shit." I knew once they said that, I was set. The radio game is no different from the crack game. Once the streets knew my bags had that boom, I was on my way. What concerns me is how few kids nowadays seem to recognize opportunity if there isn't a paycheck attached to it. Not only do they want a check, but they often want ownership in what they're working on, too. They'll hustle for a few months and immediately they want to start talking about equity. I think they've all watched a Facebook movie too many times when they should have been watching Belly. Equity. Even though you're 25 years old and you didn't put up any money? Equity. Man, shut the hell up and put some more of that weed into a bag. Can you imagine if after working Wendy's show for 6 months, I had come to Kev and told him I needed some equity in the show? Well, you know, Kev, I've been putting a lot of time into this show. It's really become a big part of my life. There's a lot of other stuff I haven't been working on because I'm so tied up in this. So I think it'd be fair if you gave me a sort of ownership stake. Man, Kev would have done me the way Uncle Phil used to do Jazzy Jeff on Fresh Prince. Thrown me right out of the building, and rightfully so. This is what many kids today fail to understand. You're supposed to be busting your ass for nothing when you're in your 20s, and sometimes even your 30s. That doesn't mean you're being exploited. It means you're building up the skills, connections, and reputation to eventually build a platform of your own. Once you build your own platform, that's when you'll get the equity. Remember, Mark Zuckerberg didn't get all that equity in Facebook just because he worked hard. Half the world is working hard. He got it because he was a once-in-a-lifetime talent who came up with a completely unique idea. Unless you've got that same sort of talent or have a truly unique idea, you don't own anything but your effort. Which is why I'll say it one more time. You better shut up and put the weed in the bag. Take advantage of internships. Speaking of working for free, never forget that a lot of successful players in hip-hop culture started as interns. Puffy started as Andre Harrell's intern at Uptown Records. Kevin Lyles was Leo Cohen's intern at Def Jam. Angie Martinez started in radio as an intern at Hot 97 in New York City. Big Tigger got his first break as an intern at WPGC in D.C. It's no different outside of hip-hop. Xerox CEO Ursula Burns, the only female African-American CEO of a Fortune 500 company, got her start there as an intern. Steven Spielberg was an intern at Universal Studios. Steve Jobs got his first break as an intern at Hewlett-Packard. The list goes on and on. There's literally no limit on how far an internship can take you. Second, radio is one of the most intern-friendly industries out there. Even the smallest stations have interns year-round. In the 15 years I've been in radio, I've worked with hundreds of interns. One of my all-time favorites was a Haitian girl named Sasha, who used to intern with us at Power. Sasha's job was supposed to be helping us answer the phones, but she took it upon herself to start writing out questions for me whenever we had an interview. Not only did she come up with thoughtful and insightful questions, but she managed to write them in a voice that sounded exactly like my own. Once I told her how much she had my voice down, and she just humbly replied, "Yeah, I guess I've been listening to you a long time." Even after her internship ended, she'd still send me questions. She wasn't getting paid to do that or even getting school credit anymore. but she never stopped supporting me any way she could. She showed love because she was a friend, but she also saw the value of putting in the work in order to keep our professional relationship strong. I never forgot her support and kept an eye out for opportunities for her. One finally presented itself after I got a deal to do a late-night talk show for MTV called Charlamagne and Friends. When it was time to hire writers, I immediately thought of Sasha. She didn't have experience writing for TV, but I knew she could capture my voice. Plus, her work ethic was unmatched. So I hired her over several people who, on paper, were more qualified, all thanks to the initiative and hustle she showed as an intern. Another great intern we had at Power was a fat kid named Matt. He took his internship so seriously that he basically lived at the station. He'd start his day by prepping the morning show, go off to class for a couple hours, and then come back and look for ways to help out on the night shifts. A lot of times, he'd just crash on a dirty old futon in the jock lounge so he could already be at the studio when we got in the next day at 5 a.m. His work ethic was incredible, but we literally had to tell him to go home and bathe because he'd go for days on end without showering. We couldn't take him stinking up the studio anymore. My favorite Mac moment came during Hurricane Sandy. Everyone knew the storm was going to shut down New York, so the station booked Envy, Angela, and me into a hotel in Manhattan so we wouldn't have to travel into work. The streets were deserted. Nobody was on the roads, and the subways and buses were closed, as the mayor had banned all travel. But guess who popped up at the hotel anyway? Mac. "What the hell are you doing here?" we asked in disbelief when we saw him. "Well, y'all are here," he replied. "So I figured you might need some help." We were blown away. The station had plenty of paid employees who didn't even think about showing up that day. Who could blame them? But Mac, the intern, made sure he was there. That made a lasting impression on me. As Mac's internship was winding down, Cadillac decided to take a job in Boston and started filling out his new staff. I wanted to help Mac out, so I sent Caddy an email saying, "You should give Mac a job up there, man. Nothing's going to be opening up for him at Power anytime soon, and the kid deserves a shot. He put in the work." Caddy had seen it with his own eyes, so he hired Mac as his associate morning show producer in Boston. Mac hadn't even finished college yet, but he still found himself in a major market making good money. Again, all thanks to the initiative and hustle he demonstrated as an intern. I've also seen a lot of young people squander the opportunities that come with internships. If hard work is the best quality an intern can display, ambition is definitely one of the worst. That doesn't mean you can't be ambitious. Puffy, Kevin Lyles, Steve Jobs, and Steven Spielberg were all incredibly motivated to win. But I guarantee their employers weren't too aware of that ambition when they were interning. They all knew how to keep that ambition in check until the time was right. In order to be a great intern, you must have blinders on and stay focused on the work that's in front of you, instead of the work you want to be doing down the road. This is because program directors, managers, producers, and supervisors don't care about your dreams. They're focused on their own. So don't waste their time making noise about what you want or what your master plan is. As Robert Greene says in 48 Laws of Power, conceal your intentions. Your only value to them is the work you put in. If you've handled your internship correctly when it's time to move on, your superior should come to you and say, "So what are you trying to do with your career?" And when you tell them, it should be their first time hearing your plans. We once had an intern at Power. Let's call him Pedro, who never learned this. He worked hard, but instead of hustling on behalf of the team, he always tried to bring attention to himself. Pedro even went so far as to make up business cards that had his picture on one half and a picture of myself, Envy, and Angela on the other. When rappers came to the studio, he would hand them one of those cards and introduce himself as part of the Breakfast Club. Doing that in plain sight of the show's actual producers was a ballsy move, but it wasn't worth the risk. The guests could tell he wasn't really a part of the team. If he was, why wasn't he in the studio? Why hadn't he been on the email thread that booked the interview? Why weren't any of the hosts talking to him? So it didn't get him anywhere with them. All it did was make us seriously question his judgment. Not surprisingly, we had to fire Pedro. He was replaced by another crop of interns, and we pretty much forgot about him. Nice kid, we'd say if his name came up, but too thirsty. Then recently, I got into a car service, and guess who was driving? That's right, Pedro. He immediately launched into this rap about how he was still producing, but also selling a little coke on the side to make ends meet. Man, this guy still does too much, I thought to myself as he yapped away in the front seat. Granted, I had some of the same tendencies when I was younger. When I joined Hot in Columbia, my partner DJ Frosty and I started calling ourselves the future. The implication was that the older hosts on the station represented the past. Just in case anybody missed the point, We even put out a mixtape called Disrespect Your Elders, where we dissed the older jocks on the station by name. At the time, I thought I was being edgy, but in retrospect, my ego and sense of entitlement were out of control. It's surprising the station took as long to fire me as it did. Nobody wants to deal with that sort of naked ambition from a kid who hasn't proven anything yet. I also showed too much ambition the first time I met Wendy. She was in Columbia for a market visit and was recording her show in our studio. I just put out another mixtape, this one called Hate Is Necessary, which featured her on the cover. After the show, I started pestering her to listen to some of the skits on the tape. At first, she just politely declined, but I didn't know when to fall back. I kept bugging and bugging her until finally she turned to me and in an icy voice said, "Please get the fuck out of here with all that mixtape shit. I couldn't care less. Take that nonsense to my husband." As soon as she said it, I knew I'd been doing too much too soon. It was an embarrassing moment, but it taught me the value of being cool when you're trying to establish yourself in a situation. But I did take her advice and took the mixtape to Kev, which in retrospect was the genesis of our relationship. Are there going to be people who will take advantage of your willingness to value opportunity over money, who might appear to be getting over on you? Absolutely. Who gives a fuck? As long as they're giving you a real opportunity and cracking open the door, even if that crack is thinner than Wiz Khalifa's arm, then you're the one who is getting over. I was recently talking about this with Joseph Kahn, the director of the movie Bodied, which I appear in. The film is set in the world of battle rappers, and there was one real-life rapper in particular whom Joseph really wanted in the film. He told me he offered the guy 70 grand to appear, but this rapper's mentality was, if they got 70,000, then they got 100 grand. That's what I want. Joseph explained that 70 grand was all he had in his budget, but the rapper wouldn't move until he got that extra 30. Eventually, the movie studio got tired of trying to convince him and went with another rapper who was willing to do it for 50. It's too bad because the first guy lost an opportunity to show a movie audience just how great a battle rapper he is. If he had done it for 70 grand and killed it, like he undoubtedly would have, he'd probably get 100 grand for his next movie, maybe more. But because this guy was so adamant about getting that extra 30 grand, he was sure they were holding out on him, and they probably were. He ended up blocking his own blessings. Look, I've done plenty of TV deals in the past few years where I could have adapted a harder line and gotten more cash, but TV is a relatively new medium to me at this stage in my career. So I'd rather take less money now if it helps set me up to get more in the long run. I'm focused on creating opportunity for myself, not wringing every last penny out of a deal. This is why whenever I'm working on a deal, my mentality is, just let me get whatever is fair. I don't need to win this thing. I'll stick them up later. By not turning every negotiation into a dragged-out battle, I've increased my overall value by building strong relationships. It's paid off for me, especially in TV. I still have much more to accomplish, but even as I'm reading this, I have my own office in the Viacom building. But do you know how much my first contract with Viacom was for? 55 grand. That's right. I signed a TV production deal that didn't even come close to landing me 100K, and I was fine with it. Frankly, I didn't even know why they were offering me that much. I was just excited to get my feet wet in TV. But suppose I had said 55,000, what the hell is that, when I got the offer? I'm one of the most popular personalities on the radio. MTV had better come off some real money. The process would have stalled before it ever really got started. Why should MTV have offered me a bundle of cash? I'd proven myself in radio by that point, but I hadn't done anything significant in TV. I needed to build my reputation in the industry, and the contract reflected that. Whether it's radio, TV, movies, books, podcasts, or whatever, I never enter into a situation with a get-money attitude. Again, I'm in this for the long haul, not the short money. And trust me, the money's much longer now. Represent yourself. The first time I learned the value of not demanding too much money is when I was negotiating the deal to come to 100.3 to beat in Philly. And in many ways, that situation is at the root of why me and Kev, and by extension Wendy, don't fuck with each other anymore. Kev has always had an attitude similar to that battle rapper's. If someone offers you 10 bucks, that means they really should be offering you 15. But instead of just saying no thanks to the deal, it felt like Kev was trying to shake you upside down until that other 5 bucks fell out of your pocket. He was always extremely aggressive in trying to get more money out of situations. He'd yell at and often threaten people till he got what he wanted. I can't lie, it's worked for him with Wendy, but it wasn't how I wanted to do business. The issue came to a head for the first time when I was approached about the job in Philly. Even though I'd been fired from Wendy's show, Kev was still my guy. He had still given me that initial opportunity, and I'll forever be grateful for that. At the time, Kev was looking to expand his client base beyond Wendy, so of course he wanted to represent me in my negotiations. That put me in a bit of a bind. On one hand, I wanted to go with Kev. I owed him, after all. On the other, I also knew how he got when it was time to talk money. When Philly had first hit me up, they'd thrown out an initial offer of 70 grand a year. To me, it was a fair number, right around what I'd been making with Wendy. Plus, the economy was absolutely terrible at that moment. This was just after the financial crash of 2008, when a lot of the big banks, auto and insurance companies needed to be bailed out. Every industry was suffering and cutting back. I was excited to have a job when so many other people were losing theirs. Kev didn't see it that way. "We gonna go in there and get 350,000 out of them," he told me. "Trust me, nigga, we got this." He was confident, but it felt like a suicide mission to me. "Kev, this is not the 90s, and I'm not Wendy," I explained. "That ain't 350,000 a year for me in Philly." Kev didn't want to budge off 350K, though. So finally, I said, "Fuck that. I'm going up to that station to talk to these people myself." I just couldn't demand an unrealistic number. It was a hard conversation to have, but ultimately, I had to tell Kev I was going in there solo. He didn't like that, but I stuck to my guns and accepted for 75 grand. Could I have held out for a little more? Sure. Maybe 80K or even 100K, but never 350K. I'm happy Kev thought I was worth that much, but that was Wendy Williams' money at the time, not Charlemagne money. The money wasn't my priority anyway. I wanted a chance to do what I love, to compete in the biggest markets, not to mention have my own morning show. That's what I was focused on, the opportunity. Because I knew that if I did what I was supposed to do in Philly, that $350,000 would be waiting for me down the road, and then some, it turned out. But I needed to put the weed in the bag first. The Philly situation created a fracture in my relationship with Kev that never fully healed. One day out of the blue, I got a text from him that read, "I'm not fucking with you anymore. You did some foul shit. Lose my number." I immediately hit him back and asked, "What are you talking about?" No reply. When I called him, he didn't pick up. I always take a man at his word. So after that, I deleted his number. I didn't call Wendy to ask what was wrong or ask any of our mutual friends to mediate the situation. I just took that number out of my phone and didn't look back. I quickly realized it was the right decision. When I went back to Power to talk to Cadillac, one of the first things he asked me is Kevin Hunter still your manager? Nope, I replied. Why did you make that move? Because when I pray to God to take negativity out of my life, he's not swinging at spirits. He's swinging at people who are the living embodiment of negativity in my life. Caddy just stared at me, then finally smiled. That guy does have a lot of weird energy, doesn't he? Caddy said. He then went on to tell me that he was glad I'd made the switch because as long as Kev was my manager, it would have been hard to make a deal. Apparently, some of the sales folks at Power had worked with Kev before and weren't looking forward to doing it again. That's why I hadn't heard back from them after our first meeting. God, Jewel, there might be thousands of radio stations in the country, but the radio industry is small, as are most industries. That means the people you piss off at one stop are probably going to pop up at another one sooner or later. So treat people with respect where you are, or you might pay for it later. Thankfully, I was already flying solo at that point. I'd come to realize that a good manager is a great ambassador for their client. A good manager has the connections and has built up enough trust with companies that they can both ask for and get what they deserve. My impression was Kev didn't have those kind of relationships. Instead of trust, he'd built up too much ill will with executives and program directors. To this day, I don't know why he sent that text. Until he explains it to me, I'll never know. Whatever his motivation, breaking with Kev removed the biggest obstacle between me and where I wanted to go. For a long time after that incident with Kev, I didn't have a manager in the traditional sense. One day I was hanging out in Los Angeles with my OG Paul Ritchie, the famed TV executive who is one of the smartest guys I've met and is responsible for my first TV deal. We were just shooting the shit about different TV personalities, breaking down their careers or lack thereof. At one point, I asked Paul, "Tell me how people who've achieved fame manage to fall off." "Their attitudes and managers," he replied. "Bad attitude speaks for itself, but you know, you get these managers that speak for you and they take a bunch of your money and they create drama where there's no need for it," he told me. "The most dangerous thing they do is gas up the talent. They make you feel like you're bigger than the company, which you never are. I don't care how famous you are, how much press you get, you're never bigger than the company. And if a manager makes you feel like you are, they're doing you a great disservice." Paul told me that if the deals get bigger and bigger, I need an agent, but for the time being, not necessarily a manager. I've always kept that conversation in my mind. And for a while, I did handle those situations myself. Finally, I got to the spot where I really did need one. And I hired a triple OG named Karen Kinney, who I trust and value. If I was going to hire a manager, I had to make sure they were a good person with great character. Karen more than fits that description. Not to mention she's G-Spin's cousin. See how the universe works? Manager or not, no matter how well a show I'm on does, or no matter how much I'm getting paid, I always remind myself I'm not bigger than the company. That doesn't mean I don't have confidence in myself. I do. Supreme confidence, in fact. Or that I don't expect my checks to get bigger. Again, there's no question on that count. But it does mean that I won't become so full of myself that I shut myself off to new opportunities. No matter how far you get in the game, there's always another level to reach. That's true for radio jocks, but it's also true for chefs, lawyers, rappers, accountants, and teachers. Measure your success by the opportunities you're presented with and the opportunities you're creating for others. Not the amount of zeros in your paycheck. When that's your sole measurement, you're going to come up short in the end. Put yourself on. A few years ago, Little Duval and I were walking out of the Viacom building in Times Square when some random dude ran up on us. "Yo, I keep seeing you guys on TV," he said, almost out of breath. "I want to get down too. So what I got to do to become famous?" Duval and I just started laughing. But this guy wasn't joking. He really thought there was some sort of cheat sheet he could read, and bam, the next time we walked out of the Viacom building, he'd be right there with us. I've said it before, but I've got to say it one more time for the people in the back. There is no book, no cheat sheet, or secret formula that's going to allow you to skip over any rung on the success ladder without putting in the work first. There was no shortcut Duval and I could have taken on our road to MTV that didn't involve years and years of grinding, years of me working on the radio for free or damn near it. Years of Duval playing little comedy clubs in the dirty South for little to no money. Not to mention years of us, collectively and individually, pitching shows and concepts that never got picked up. Pitches that often never even earned us an email or phone call back to say, "No thanks." We didn't let any of that discourage us. If TV networks didn't seem interested in what we were pitching, we would just put out our own content. We paid for Hood State of the Union, a web series where we talked about current events and pop culture out of our own pocket. The cameraman, the editors, the green screen. We scraped the money together for all of that ourselves. The production value might not have been great. It sounded like it was recorded in a bathroom and looked like it was edited by someone taking a class in Final Cut Pro in community college. But the product was still good enough. People fucked with it, and the episodes began to rack up respectable numbers on YouTube. Thank you to my man Scenario, who helped put that whole thing together. Tiffany Williams from MTV eventually saw it and was impressed enough to invite us into the building for a meeting. Once we were inside, the rest was history. But we created that initial traction ourselves. No one put us on or gave us a break. Of course, years later, when MTV2 started promoting my show Uncommon Sense, that didn't stop people from tweeting, "Man, MTV is just handing out shows now." Every time I saw a tweet like that, I just had to laugh. Everything I've gotten my hands on, I've grabbed. Nothing was served up to me on a platter. That's why if you're listening to this and want to make a name for yourself in the entertainment world, TV, radio, video, podcasting, please take this very simple advice. Put yourself on. By that, I mean, don't wait for someone to give you a deal. If you do, you'll be waiting for a very long time, maybe forever. There's no one hearing this right now who couldn't do what Duval and I did with Hood State of the Union. Those videos literally didn't cost more than a few hundred dollars to shoot and produce. If you can afford a cell phone plan, you can afford to make your own video. It's true of any lane you want to be in. If you want to be a writer, start fucking writing. Again, it doesn't cost anything to post your thoughts on a blog, Facebook, Tumblr, or any social media site. If what you're writing is good, eventually someone with a larger platform will notice and give you an opportunity. It's no different with podcasting. So many people hit me on Twitter or see me in the streets and say, "Yo, Charlemagne, I love the Brilliant Idiots. How do I get my own podcast?" You get it by buying a couple mics, sticking them into your computer, hitting record, and starting a conversation that people are going to be interested in. That's it. If you're consistent with it, eventually it will take you where you want to go. But no one is going to give you a podcast or anything else of value. I'm not trying to be a dream killer here, but I can't tell you how many people come up to me looking to get on at iHeartRadio or Viacom or the Loudspeakers Network without having put the weed in the bag first. It's so easy to build a digital resume today, but so few people do it. You're telling me you want a talk show, but you haven't even recorded yourself talking about pop culture topics on YouTube? You're telling me you want a podcast, but you haven't even recorded yourself on your computer and uploaded it to SoundCloud? If you haven't even taken those small baby steps, then I know you're just looking for a shortcut. Sorry, but once again, there aren't any out there. I believe one reason people are looking for shortcuts instead of opportunities to do the work and be productive is because social media has given them a false sense of value. They really believe that if they tweet something or even just retweet it and it gets a couple of likes, the next step is radio or television. So let me say this very clearly. Being active on social media can amplify the work you're already doing, but it is not work unto itself. If you're reposting a link to your podcast, a story you wrote, or even something creative you did, that's one thing. You're using those platforms to alert people to your talent. But only retweeting other people's stuff or even just making a few funny comments? Sorry, but that's not enough to get put on. I say that as someone who is actively involved in doing just that. Putting people on. I am literally always looking for new talent. I don't demand a ton of experience, but I do want to see someone using all these incredible yet inexpensive tools at your disposal to create. I want to see short videos. I want to listen to podcasts. I want to read blogs. The platforms change. When I started, I was posting content to MySpace. All my man LC was posting it on his rumor page on All Hip Hop. Then I got on Facebook, then Twitter. As I'm writing this book, it's Snapchat and Instagram. By the time the book comes out, I will probably be on to something else, but the passion to create, to be part of the conversation, never changes. That passion has to be evident for someone in a position of power to give you a look. While we're debunking some myths about what it takes to get on, let's kill the dream once and for all that reality shows create a path to anything meaningful. I know the Kardashians are getting $3 trillion a year, plus Ryan Seacrest's firstborn from E!, but I'm not talking about them. I'm specifically talking to all of you people who think being on a show like Love & Hip Hop is going to make you successful. Trust me, the vast majority of stars on shows like that get very little money for their efforts. How little? Let's say you're on a bigger network. You might get $1,500 an episode over the course of a 15-show season. So that's around $23,000. Not really that much money, right? Let's say everything breaks in your favor. You end up being one of the stars of the show and you're bought back for season two. You might even get a slight raise. You are still only making $40,000 a year. Thanks to the show, you can also host 15 to 20 parties in little clubs around the country at $2,500 a pop. You're still barely making over $75,000 a year. But Charlamagne, you might be thinking, didn't you just finish saying that it's important not to get hung up on the money? That you should work for free if you have to? You're right. I did say that, but you left out an important part. I said you should be willing to work for free if it leads to a greater opportunity. Unfortunately, for most people on reality shows, that greater opportunity most likely isn't out there. For every Bethany Frankel who gets her own daytime talk show or multi-million-dollar margarita mix, there are hundreds, maybe even thousands by this point, of other reality stars who get nada, except for the occasional club appearance. And even those dry up after a year or two. The worst part about being a reality star is that the experience ruins you for most other careers. Once you've been on TV, you'll probably think that you're too good to work in a bank or as a trainer at a gym. Plus, there are a lot of places that won't hire you because they only know you as that wild woman or wild guy who throws drinks at people or who slapped her best friend. So even if you were willing to take a traditional 9-to-5, a lot of those opportunities will be off the table. Ultimately, trying to make it as a reality star just leaves you in a state of limbo. You can't move forward in the entertainment business, but you feel like you can't go back to a regular life either. So if being in entertainment is really your passion, look for another route other than reality TV. The passion of Pitbull. One of the best things about working in radio is that I get to meet a lot of unknown artists before they blow up nationally. One guy who really stood out for how he pulled himself up from the gutter to the pinnacle of the music game was Pitbull. I first met Pitbull in Miami around 2000 while helping Never So Deep master an album for Infinity. It took about 12 hours to drive from South Carolina to Miami, but every couple of weeks, DJ Bless, Dr. Evans, and I would make the trip. We did a lot of work at a B.B. Lewis's legendary Circle House, one of the best studios in the country. I can still remember hanging out there one night and telling a BB that I did radio back in South Carolina. Oh, man, then you should check out this guy who's on air part-time on Friday and Saturday nights. He's dope, BB told me. He's going to blow up one of these days. What's his name? I replied. DJ Khaled, said Habibi. So if you only know Khaled because of his Snapchat or his songs with Drake, understand he's another example of a guy who's been out here putting the weed in the bag for years and years. One of the young rappers hanging around Circle House was Pitbull. He wasn't signed to a major label yet, but he was doing everything he could to put himself on. You know how DJs and radio personalities often have a rapper put together an intro or promo song at the top of their shifts? It seemed to me like Pitbull was doing one for almost every jock in Miami. I knew from being a radio personality that those are very coveted looks for local rappers, so I was impressed that Pitbull had convinced multiple radio personalities and DJs to let him do theirs. Pitbull had a great ear, and he immediately identified Bless as a special producer. Whenever he saw us, he would always ask if he could get on one of Bless's beats. "Come on, Bless, let me rock that." "Aw, man," Pitbull would say, referring to the chorus of his favorite track that Bless had produced. But Bless wasn't with it. For whatever reason, he didn't like Pit as a rapper. He thought his style wasn't hardcore or aggressive enough. I'd even say, "You've got hundreds of beats, just give him one. Dude is nice." But Bless wouldn't budge. Finally, one day Pit asked him straight up, "Bless, why won't you ever let me get on one of your beats?" To his credit, Bless told him straight up in return, "Because I think you're a corny rapper." When Pit heard that, he got very serious. "Man, you know where you at? You in Miami, baby. This the 305. One day you'll regret talking like that." "What you mean?" countered Bless, thinking that Pit was threatening him. "Don't you know I'm DJ Bless?" It might have sounded like Pit was trying to punk Bless, but Pit later told me that wasn't the case. He explained what he was trying to say was, "One day I'm going to help put Miami back in the spotlight, and you're going to regret passing up on the opportunity to have been part of it." And you know what? He was right. He is a superstar today, and I'm sure Bless wishes he'd have given him that beat. Bless might not have seen Pit's talent, but it's shown through with me. I still remember watching Pit drive off from the studio one afternoon in a raggedy-ass car, maybe an old Saturn or something, and thinking to myself, this dude's at the bottom right now, but he's going to be something someday. He just had that combination of charisma and work ethic that made him stand out despite his surroundings. The same way I saw a young T.I. take over a room while wearing a dirty sweatshirt, Pit had a similar aura that just made you believe in him. Seeing folks like Pitbull and T.I. put in the work is why I get frustrated when people speculate on the shortcuts artists allegedly take to become famous. If you let Twitter tell it, every successful artist is the beneficiary of a conspiracy theory. "Oh, you gotta sell your soul and perform gay acts to get on now," someone will say. Or you'll see tweets like, "You can't get a deal nowadays unless you're in the Illuminati." It would be comical, except a lot of people take it as fact. Trust me, no one gave Pitbull a break he didn't create for himself. Pitbull pulled himself up to the top of the game. Just like I watched T.I., Jeezy, 2 Chainz, and so many other rappers put the weed in the bag, probably literally and figuratively. I watched them beg to get their records played, perform in front of crowds of 10 to 20 people, and get turned down by record label after record label, yet they never stopped grinding. Never said, "Let me take a break and chill out until someone puts me on." No, they kept at it until someone was forced to give them the exposure they deserved. My experience was no different. I can't even begin to tell